Yeah. Great. Right, and in the meantime, we're on this series, as you know, called Once Upon a Time. I think there's something on the screen just to remind you of that. Cool. And we've been talking, haven't we, about the story of the Bible. We've been looking at the whole story of the Bible, trying to sort of condense it for you and explain to you what the big picture of the Bible is. Because it's 66 books, some of it all a bit different, but we're trying to sort of get the big picture. What's the real story underpinning all of the Bible? And we've discovered that it's about that word. It's about this word redemption. Redemption means to buy something back, to regain possession of, to recover by payment. And it's about God recovering us. It's about God getting us back when we've got a bit lost. So that's what the Bible is all about. And you may remember some people that we talked about. We talked about Adam, and the word we associated with Adam was, begins with a P. Potential. Great. If you've got your little card, you can cheat. It's on that little blue card. So Adam was potential. Abraham was promise. Promise God made, an outrageous promise God made. All about this idea of redeeming us and getting us back. Moses was Passover. That's right. And we talked about the Passover. And again, that was all about that word, wasn't it? Redemption. About God buying his people back when they were slaves in Egypt. So we're looking at these characters, and hopefully they're instilling that word into your heart. Now, last week we looked at Abraham. Remember, we looked at God talked to Abraham, and he promised something to Abraham. He promised that his descendants would be a great nation. And after Abraham dies, his grandson, Jacob, and his family, as we heard last week, end up in Egypt. They end up as a family there, but they grow into not just a family, but they grow into a nation in Egypt over hundreds of years. During that time in Egypt, they become a slave nation. They're enslaved by Pharaoh. That's the story so far. And God sends them a deliverer whose name is Moses. Well done. It's like 40 questions, isn't it? There you go. Okay, so he sends them Moses. And with God's help, Moses leads Israel on what becomes an incredible journey. This is the story so far, and we left them leaving Israel last week, and they make that massive journey all the way to Canaan, to this land that God promised them. And they become a nation, not only a nation of slaves, now they're free, and now they're a nation in their own right. They settle in the land of Egypt, they are there today. That was 4,000 years ago, and the people of Israel are back in their own land, as you know. A difficult land, problems there, but they are at home in the land originally they went to 4,000 years ago. Now, unlike all the nations around them, Israel was very different in one key way. That one key way was that all the nations around Israel had human kings. That was how they were structured. They had a monarchy, and that was how they ran their countries. God said, "I don't want you to be like that. I don't want you to have a king. I'm your king. The only king you have is God." Now, unfortunately, the people kept looking over their shoulders and sort of seeing all the other nations that they've all got a king. We haven't got a king. We really want a king, God. So they got a bit miserable about that. They said, "We should have one too." And God said, "You know what? You really just need me as your king. But because you keep banging on about this, I'm going to give you what you want. Even though it may not be the best thing for you, I'm going to give you what you're asking for." So the first king of Israel was elected. And his name was, anybody remember? That's right. King Saul was the first king of Israel. Up until that point, they'd never had a king. They'd had what were called judges. And there's a whole book of the Bible called Judges, which recounts all of the judges. These people who at certain times helped to lead the nation, but they weren't kings. Now they have a king, and his name is Saul. Now, Saul was a bit of a bruiser of a guy. And if you wanted someone to lead you in a battle, Saul was your man. He had all the qualifications. The only problem with Saul was that he lacked character. He was a guy of pretty weak character. Easily swayed, easily wanting to people please, easily doing all the wrong things. And his heart really was in looking after number one and not looking after the people. So after a number of disasters, God tells Saul, I'm taking the throne away from you and I'm going to give it to a person after my own heart. Someone who cares about this nation and this redemption plan more than they do about themselves. And God chose a young shepherd boy, we've heard his name already today, who nobody would have considered. In fact, when they were interviewing for the job of future king, they left him out in the fields looking after the sheep. Nobody even thought of this guy. And his name was David. And when you take an aerial view of David's life, one thing you discover about David, amongst all the characters in Scripture, in the Bible, was that he had this passion for God. An immense passion for God. He was so passionate, God made him a very special promise, just like he'd done with Abraham. And in 2 Samuel chapter 7, maybe you'd like to turn that up. Find 2 Samuel, see if you can find that. It's in the front end of your Old Testament, the front end of your Bibles. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Keep going. You go past Judges, which was the guys before the kings. And eventually you'll find 1 Samuel. Samuel was a prophet who was around when the kings were first installed. So you'll find that. So if you find 2 Samuel chapter 7, you'll find God talking to David. And he was such a man after God's own heart that God made him a promise. And he said to David, from you, David, will come a king who will lead my people, but he will not lead them for just his lifetime. He will lead them forever. A very weird and unusual promise. A promise about someone who would come later. Someone very special. A promise about Jesus. So David is a man whose relationship with God is characterized, I think, by one word. And that is that word passion. That's the word we're attaching to David. David, passion. And that's where many of us can connect with David. Because I don't know about you, but how many of you remember a time? Maybe it was a camp, I don't know, maybe it was a conference that you went to. Maybe it was a season of your life where you were just passionate about God. Do you remember a time when you would do anything for God? Do you remember a time when you used to come to church and you used to stand up and when you sang, you didn't just used to mumble the words out, but you used to close your eyes and you used to sing for all your life. And you didn't care what other people thought around you. You just sang to him because you were passionate about him. Do you remember a time like that? Do you remember a time when your heart was so full of God? When God asked you to do something ridiculous, you did it. You remember a time like that? I remember a time like that. You know, God said, do it. I just did it. And it was like, no argument, no question. You'd say yes to God. And then you'd ask him what the question was afterwards. Well, what was it? You know, you'd just say yes before you even knew what he wanted. And yes, you could be a little insensitive. You probably were a little bit. You went around annoying a few people, talking about God a lot. You got a little bit passionate, a little bit over the top. But God had your heart. God really mattered to you. And you were passionate about him. I hope everybody in this room can relate to a season in life where you were just passionate about God. The only problem with this is that it's a season, isn't it? And I think, I'll be honest, I'll hold my hand up, and I think you will too, that there are seasons where we're not quite so on fire for God, when we're not quite so passionate about him. All the junk of ordinary, everyday life sort of gets in the way, doesn't it? And pushes God in the margins. And if you're anything like me, the passion that maybe you have had at certain points isn't always sustained. It's not always there. It waxes and wanes a bit. Is that true? Is anybody here just completely passionate about God all the time? Hands up if you are. That's good. You're all being honest. That's good. Because you are. Are you? Yeah. Yeah, because it's a time when you celebrate all that. Yeah, it's a good time. Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yeah? Yeah, and there are certain times, aren't there, where we just get a bit passionate. And, you know, you might get a conference, you might hear something, you might read something, and you start get passionate for a while again. But the problem is I can't seem to sustain it. And I struggle to sustain it. And I suspect most of us do too. We struggle with that. And that's why I look at David with envy. You ever envied this guy? Because here I see a man who most of his life maintained a passion for God. Now, I'm not saying he walked around all the time with a really stupid grin on his face. He didn't. And I'm not saying, as you know, if you read his story, that he got everything right. He made some mistakes with his family. And he made some mistakes with his marriage and all sorts of things. He wasn't a perfect guy. That's not what we're saying. But for most of his life, it was lived in a level of passion for God that you and I really can only sort of aspire to. Just look at the beginning of life. Here's a little snapshot of his life. So at the beginning of life, the Israelite army are squaring off against a Philistine, a rather large Philistine army, in 1 Samuel chapter 17. You can have a look at that. You'll know the story really well. Turn in your Bibles, 1 Samuel 17. Not 2 Samuel, but 1 Samuel 17. And David hears about this Philistine champion called Goliath. He's hurling abuse at the God of Israel. So David says, I'm not sitting around. He's only turned up really to deliver sandwiches to his brothers who are in the army and old enough to do it. But he says, I'm not sitting around like the rest of this army in fear when this guy is slagging off our God. I'm not doing it. And his passion is such that he says, God, if you're calling me to do something crazy and courageous, just put some rocks in my hand and I'm your man. And it was a crazy thing he did. He walks out in front of a professional soldier, the champion of the Philistine army, and he squares up against him. Because God says, yeah, all right, off you go. When you're passionate about God, you do some weird and crazy stuff. It didn't make sense to anybody, but he was just passionate. And he wanted to honor the God that he loved. Now, later in life, when he finally becomes king, he recognizes that if his nation is going to bless others by pointing them towards God, it's the whole reason that the nation of Israel was made, was to point people there, point people to God. Then God is going to need to be seen as in the middle of them. God is going to need to be seen right in the midst of the people of Israel. So he decides that the Ark of the Covenant, that box that held the Ten Commandments, that was now residing in some obscure village somewhere, he says, you know what? It's not good enough that it's there, because it symbolizes the presence of God. It's important. You've seen Indiana Jones? There you go. So, not quite the same. No face melting and things like that. Although it was quite an interesting thing, the Ark of the Covenant. But David says, if God is going to be in the middle of us, if we're going to point to God, we need that back in the middle of Jerusalem. We need it where it should be, at the heart of the nation. So he gathers 30,000 men for this job. He should have taken 4. But he hides 30,000 men in 2 Samuel chapter 6. You can read about this. Find that one if you want. And he dances his way into Jerusalem with the Ark of the Covenant. And not only that, do you remember how he did it? Naked. He did. Are we allowed to say naked in church? There we go, we just did it. There you go, naked. Sorry, I think I got away with that. But David was so passionate about God, he threw off his royal, because he's a king. And a king has to be noble and respectful and important. And he says, you know what, in the presence of God, I'm nothing. He threw off his royal robes, and his wife at the time said, David, will you please stop that? You're embarrassing yourself, because wives do that when you... Not that I've ever danced naked down Godston High Street yet, but I suspect my wife would say something similar. But in this case, he dances down the high street, you know, in front of the ark, and he's just passionate, and he doesn't care, does he? He's so passionate, he just doesn't care what anybody else thinks. Amazing. And at the end of his life, David's concerned for the reputation of God, so he decides to build a magnificent temple. He says, I'm going to build you the biggest temple so that the world will know you're the man, you're the God, the only God. But God says, you can't do it, David. I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you do it. There's too much blood on your hands, so I will not allow you, David, because of all the battles you've had to fight to sustain and to maintain this and establish this nation, because there's blood on your hands, it's not appropriate that you do it. I'm going to give that job to your son. A son who was the wisest man, allegedly, in all the world, Solomon, followed on from David. But he gives it to his son. So what does David do? Does he go home and say, well, that's not fair? You know, does he get a bit dispassionate about God? No. You know what he does? He spends the end of his reign raising the millions and millions that it would be required in order to build a temple worthy enough of his God. He spends the rest of his life doing that because he's so passionate that people know about his God. I love this guy. I sort of wish I was like this guy. When you pick up the book of Psalms, you ever read Psalms? He wrote most of them. And he writes about all those times when he's angry and confused or he's hurt and he doesn't know what to do. But so many times those songs end up with David confessing his worship to God, saying, God, you're all I want and you're all I need. Despite all the stuff that he had to deal with as a king of a nation and all the pressures that that involved, you read about his life. He said at the end of every sort of outpouring of his heart to God, at the end of the day, you're all I want and you're all I need. That's what he says time and time again. Read the Psalms, you'll find that. He moans about stuff. He says, this isn't fair, this is going on. But at the end he says, but you are my God and I love you. And as I look at my life and I see how David maintained his passion for God over the long haul, I wonder how. That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Do you ever want to be as passionate about God as David was? I sort of do. I sort of wish I was. Now, if you do, how did he do it? Because mine probably was a season of passion. And I get moments where I'm passionate. And weeks, or maybe even a month, where I'm passionate. And then I slip back into being a bit ambivalent sometimes. What was it that David knew that we don't? Here's why I love the Bible. David wrote down his secret. Do you want to know what it is? Do you want to know David's secret to maintaining passion through your life for him? Before I tell you what it is, let's just tackle a couple of little arguments that you might have right now for believing that passion for God is not sustainable permanently. That you cannot be permanently passionate about God. Let me just tackle a couple of arguments, because you're probably thinking, that's not possible, Phil. You can't do that. Well, here's a couple of little arguments. The first argument we all have is that we have inconsistent emotions. And being passionate about something consistently is impossible because it's based on our emotions. Some of you are thinking, I'm not an emotional type of person. I'm British, so I don't do emotion. No, you're not saying that. But, you know, you're a little bit self-conscious about expressions of affection and stuff like that, or emotion. And you may also be thinking, and I think this is probably true, and I've thought this various times, I've seen some people who are supposedly passionate about God, and I'm not sure I want to be like them. Have you ever seen people who are passionate about God and in all the wrong way? We see it all the time, don't we? But you know, the truth of the matter is, there is a part of passion that is emotion. It is involving our emotions. It involves the whole of us. Our mind, our body, our wills, our emotions as well. An emotion cannot be sustained over a long period of time. So barrier one to maintaining a passion for God throughout your life is that. Here's the other argument that we have, that we can't do this. And that's consistent distractions. Because later today, I've got to go home. And I've got to, well, not in my case, but some of you have got to change nappies. Some of you have got to take out the rubbish. Some of you have got to do the laundry. Men, you have to cook your wives lunch today because it's Mother's Day. And you've got to go home and you've got to do stuff that you wouldn't ordinarily do even. But the routine and the mundane stuff of life. And even if you love God with all of your heart, you've still got to do that stuff, haven't you? There's still a Monday morning. And you might have a flat on the way to work tomorrow morning. How do you maintain passion for God when you're at the side of the road changing a tire? And the routine, mundane distractions that go on all the time in our lives. How do you do it? Here's the amazing thing. If you think you cannot constantly maintain passion for God because of those things, here's the challenge. David had all of that, and he still managed it. You don't believe me? Read about his life. David had inconsistent emotions, and he had distractions. He had to run a country. But his passion was sustained. I don't have to run a country. I haven't got that level of distraction on my life. So what did David know that you and I don't? How did he do it? What's his secret? Would you like to know? Would you like to know his secret? Or are you not worried? Would you like to know his secret for maintaining passion? All right. Get passionate, folks. Just a little encouragement here. Get passionate about being passionate. So here we go. Turn to Psalm 36. Turn to Psalm 36, verse 5. That is David's secret for maintaining a life that wasn't just up and down. Today I'm feeling, you know, God's first, and tomorrow I'm not. Psalm 36, verse 5. You found it? Let me read it to you. Now you might be wondering what that's got to do with maintaining passion, but here you go. Your unfailing love, O Lord, is as vast as the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches beyond the clouds. Your righteousness is like mighty mountains. Your justice is like the ocean depths. And then he goes on. You care for people and animals alike, O Lord. How precious is your unfailing love, O God. All humanity finds shelter in the shadow of your wings. This is fitting rather nicely with Ellie, I think. And he had this picture. You see David's key to maintaining passion for God? His key was this. David knew that every single one of us at the core of our being has a picture of who God is. You have a picture in your head and in your heart of who God is. This is David's painting of God. This is his picture of God. He painted his own picture. And that picture determined how he related to God, how he trusted God, how he obeyed and followed God all through his life. He just described his picture of God in Psalm 36 there. And his picture is sort of looked a bit like that. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful painting. He painted God and he saw him as amazing and wonderful and faithful and just and perfect and all of these sort of things. It was beautiful. David declared, God, your love reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies, your righteousness is like mighty mountains, your justice is like the ocean depths. You see, if we had a picture of God that looked like that, it would be no problem to sustain passion, would it? If that is your picture all the time in front of you of God. A.W. Tozer, a famous writer, put it like this. The most important thing about a person is what comes to their mind when they think about God. What comes to your mind when you think about God? Do you see him as David held on to him? Or is your picture a little bit different? See, David knew that that picture is important. David knew that we all carry a picture around with us, not in our wallets, but in our hearts. And that picture will determine whether or not you're going to live with passion for him or not. David's picture of God was worthy of his passion. Read it again. This person is worthy of my passion. And the truth is, every one of us has a picture, no matter whether you're a Christian or whether you're a church attender or whether you never ever come to church. You have a picture of God. Everybody does. And if we were to watch closely the way you behave, your actions, how you live your life, we'd be able to work out what your picture of God is. We would. And if you're anything like me, too often our picture of God doesn't look like that. It's not a beautifully clear picture of a beautiful God. You know what? Our picture usually looks like that. Because of our life experiences, because of the things we've been taught that are wrong, because of the media and the stuff we see on TV, because of the things we've experienced even in church. And we do experience some negative stuff in church, don't we? We often develop a picture of God that is a bit like that, that is a bit messed up and obscured. And let me ask you, is that picture worthy of your passion? No. No wonder we have no desire to honor him with our lives, because who would worship a God like that? And the question we've got to ask ourselves is this the God of the Bible? Is that how the Bible paints God? Well, if not, where'd that come from? And you'll be tempted to respond, listen, if you knew about my life, you'd realize there are reasons why my picture looks like that. You realize why I'm a little bit angry at God at times, why I'm a bit frustrated with him, why I feel he's let me down, he's disappointed me, and why I don't look at God quite as beautifully as David's picture is. And we'd be tempted to go down the list and talk about the betrayals and the disappointments and the letdowns and the illnesses and the divorces and the defeats that we have experienced in our lives. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. This is important. We are all tempted to define what God looks like through our circumstances and what has happened to us. And also our imperfect ability to interpret those circumstances and to work out why they happened. We all paint a picture based on our circumstances. Here's how it works. Painful situations arise, and the more they do, the more mud gets thrown on God, on your picture of God. But David never let that happen. He had a totally different way of coming up with a picture of God. That's because David was determined to define God based on how God revealed himself through his word, not the circumstances that surrounded David's life. He said, either I'll let God define who he is, or I'll define who he is. And he chose to let God do it, not let his own life and the lives of people around him do it. And if you compare your lives to David's, trust me, he would steal all of your excuses for, yeah, but my picture's like this because. He will steal all of your excuses for painting a picture like that. You know why? David would say, yes, I've been through some pretty terrible times. Worse than anybody in this room, David has. I was anointed king by God's prophet, and I ended up living in a cave for years, hunted under threat of death. I was despised by the ruling king, Saul. He tried to kill me. I was a fugitive. I had no home. I lost my best friend, Jonathan, who was cut down in battle one day, in a pointless battle, in a stupid, senseless way. One of my daughters was raped by her brother. I lost innocent children born to my family because of my own arrogance. I was betrayed by another of my children who tried to usurp me and take over my kingdom and take my throne. Anybody had a life like that? That's David's life. And in each of those circumstances, David could have said, a loving God doesn't take away what is most precious to me. I don't know who you are, but you can't be good, God. Because a good God would have stopped the rape, or would have spared my kids, or would have done all of these things. I don't know who you are, God, but you can't be faithful, because a faithful God wouldn't leave me in hiding after making me a promise that I'm going to be king. He wouldn't have done that. And life was trying to hurl mud at David's picture all the time, so that he wouldn't be worthy of David's passion, wouldn't be worthy of his worship. But David never ever let it happen. David knew that when it came to interpreting the circumstances of life, we are rubbish at it. And we use our limited perspective of 60, 70, 80 years of experience in this world to try and define who God is and what he's doing. But David says, no, I'm going to allow God to be defined by what he says, not by the circumstances of my life or the stupid things I do. I am not going to let God be defined by those things. I'm going to let him tell me who he is, and I'm going to believe that. That's what this series is all about. God has defined himself over 4,000 years through this book. And he's revealed himself to people like Adam and Abraham and Moses and to his people. And what David saw was a God who has been loving and faithful and good and just throughout that time. And he said, I don't know what to make of my circumstances. I'm not sure how to interpret them, but I know this. This is how God has revealed himself. That is my picture. And he determined to paint a picture of God based on what God told him about himself. No wonder that David could sustain his passion. Because his picture didn't get like that. His picture stayed like that. He let God define who he was. He didn't define God for him. Here's what some of you need to hear this morning. Some of you, this may be the first time you've been in church. You might have been invited by a friend who's thinking, I invite them on a Sunday where they're talking about passion. And I don't know my friend's passionate. I know they're passionate about all sorts of things, but I'm pretty sure they're not passionate about God. Well, if that's you, then please understand this about who we are as a church. We are never going to force anybody to believe anything about God. Not interested in forcing anybody to believe anything. All we're going to do as a church, and this is our task, isn't it? Is to paint an accurate picture of God. That's our life. That's what our life is about. Painting an accurate picture of God. Not based on our circumstances, but on what he said about himself. And our desire is actually that if you're on a journey, that you join us and that you would start painting. That you would start asking, who is this God? And that you would start not with your circumstances or your life, but that you would start with what he said about himself. Pick up one of these things. They've been around quite a while. And start asking, what does he look like? What does he really look like? And we'd love to encourage you to do that. There are others here who've been Christians for a while maybe, and for you the next step is to stop defining God through your circumstance and start getting into this and start reading again what he is actually looking like. And whether that's picking up some Bible notes, and there's tons out there all the time, or joining a small group, you know, one of our life groups. We had a life group this week, and we were small in number, but we ended up at the end of the evening, and I get a bit emotional sometimes, because we ended up actually saying, this is what God looks like. And we got a bit emotional, because we ended up with a picture, and I still get emotional about this. Lots of people have weird ideas about God. We ended up with a picture, and we ended up with a picture of the prodigal son. You remember that? And there's the prodigal son. He's just gone off, messed his life up, done his own thing, screwed it up badly. And the picture of God is not, there, I told you so. The picture of God was of a father at the end of a road not just holding his hands out, but running towards his son, who'd blown it and had no justification for ever turning up at home again. And the picture Jesus painted of God is of that father running with passion towards his son. That's where we ended up on Wednesday night. And we all got a bit emotional. We all got a bit choked up about it. Do you get choked up in your life group? I hope you do. I hope you get a point where at the end of the evening you've got a little tear in your eye because you've seen God again. Not your circumstances, but you've seen who he really is, what he looks like. I pray you do. Christians, stop defining God according to your circumstances and start asking what he says about himself and ask if he's been true to that throughout history. That's where you start. I've got to make a decision. God, am I going to determine who you are by my ability to interpret things, or am I going to determine who you are through who you've revealed yourself to be over 4,000 years of actual history on this planet? And if you do, you'll discover these are some words that come up. Loving. Faithful. Righteous. That means he does the right thing. Righteous just means he does the right thing. And just. You see, the circumstances of your life will not tell you that any of those things are true. Trust me. You will not believe any of those things are true if you take your life as the evidence. Your experience with other people won't do it. For instance, they're not going to tell you that that's true. They're not going to tell you that no matter how you behave or what you did last night or how you're planning, what you're planning to do tonight, that God loves you. But he does. And you may not feel that God loves you because you've blown it again and you've said something again and you've annoyed people again and you've done something that you're not proud of and you don't want publishing. And you'll think, God isn't loving, God doesn't love me. Let me tell you something. Your circumstances are irrelevant. He does. He does. He loves you. No matter how badly you screw it up, he loves you. Is he faithful? Your experience with other people will tell you that God can't be faithful. But you need to know that wherever you turn, whatever you do, wherever you go, as soon as you turn back and run back to him, he will be waiting open-armed. People might not do that for you or to you, but he will always be there to receive you back. He is faithful, irrespective of your circumstance and the people around you and how they behave. And the stuff that makes us ask, is he good? Is he really good? Is he righteous? One day we will see him face to face and we will know that he is. Then when it all adds up and we look at history and we realize what he was doing, we will know that he is. And we've seen bad things happen to good people. I had someone visit us this week from the previous church and they told us to pray for someone who is a really good guy. He's the most gentle, kind Christian I know. He's a really generous, lovely guy. And some bad stuff is happening to this guy who didn't deserve it. So is God fair? I need to know that one day when the dust settled and all the judgments are laid out for everybody to see, no one will be able to accuse God of being unfair. On that day, none of us will say, God, you were wrong, not right. Nobody's going to be doing that on that day because that's not who he is. Who is he? He's loving, he's faithful, he's righteous, and he's just. And you're going to go home this morning and the reality is he's going to keep doing the same things that you prayed he wouldn't. Later on this week, your workmate or boss is going to treat you in a way that you've asked God, please don't let him treat me that way. But because God doesn't force anybody to do what he wants, you will get treated badly, probably, at some point this week. And for some of you, next year, you'll be sat here having heard a doctor's diagnosis, and you didn't want that, and you prayed it wouldn't happen. And the truth is, in every situation, you're going to wonder how a loving, faithful, righteous, just God could let all this happen to me. And if you don't know it now, if you don't know he is that now, the minute that stuff happens to you, you will go in a tailspin. I'm telling you now, because this is what God has revealed himself to be over 4,000 years. This is who he is. Irrespective of circumstances. And like David, we need to be clear now that he is worthy of my sustained passion. Everybody's passionate about something. All of us plow our passion into some area of life. I just don't want you to get to the end and have invested it in the wrong place. Is he worthy of your passion? Is God worthy of your passion for all of your life? And if not, what picture have you got of him that is stopping that? Because David's secret was simply this. This is how God has revealed himself. And I believe it. And my circumstances are not going to change that. I'm going to play you a little video as we close. Our time